and tell us why time is the simplest and strongest thing.
Thank you very much. Thanks to you for having me here, and John for organizing. I've always wanted to come here, especially lately. There was a commercial on in the U.S. From Outback, the Australian-themed restaurant, and has a guy sitting in the restaurant, and he's explaining how when you come from the U.S. to here, you pass the international date zone. And he says, you know, so when you fly out on a Sunday from the U.S., you arrive on a Tuesday. He says, and that's why the food at Outback tastes so good. It's from the future. So, and it seems true. Anyway, this talk is connects up with all three of the things in the title of the conference, time and physics and intervention. The talk on Sunday that I'll give is more a psychophysics talk. And had a little bit of physics, but not too so much. Okay, so let's get to it. I like going back and looking at old questions that haven't been answered properly. There's one old question that used to be a big topic in philosophy of time in the first half of the 20th century, is the question of why, what makes time different than space? What's the difference between time and space? It's so, like I said there, once it was once a central question in metaphysics, but now it seems to have not been considered so much. I think, though, no one's ever really articulated out loud the reason. I think you can see that there's a kind of 1-2 punch the latter half of the 20th century gave the problem. One is methodological, and then another one is comes from physics. If you think about the methodology of sort of ordinary language analysis approach to this question, what you would do is you would grab a bunch of the game. Here's a gross caricature of the way the game was played. Grab a bunch of sentences, look to see substitute spatial and temporal terms for one another, and see if the truth conditions stay the same, see if the meaning stays the same. So you might, a really really gross caricature would be you'd look at sentences like. Hugh is spacey, but he's not timey, or time is money, but space is not money. And you'd see these differences. You'd then catalog all these differences, and then you would find out which one, consult intuition, and then decide which one is the difference between time and space. But now you think about that, you think, well, that's a kind of strange way to approach the question. I mean, suppose I were to ask the question about what's the difference between protons and neutrons. Is it, it seems like consulting intuition isn't the best place. Maybe I should instead look at science. And then it's not even clear, once you think about that, that you'd even find the difference between the two. You know, is it the mass difference or is it the charge difference? Which one is the difference between the two? So I'm not sure that you'd even get an answer to the. The goal of the original program is not. It's not even clear that you'll get that. If, on the other hand, if you persevered through that and wanted to look more into the science of space and time, even there, then you get a kind of double whammy hits you when you hit relativity. First off, when you think about special relativity, you've got space and time no longer being fundamental, only. Space-time being fundamental, space and time only being decomposable from space-time within given a reference, an inertial reference frame. And so, as Bergson says, time is spatialized in special relativity. And so it doesn't seem so exciting a question. What's the difference between time and space in special relativity? Well, what's the difference between spatialized time, spatialized non-fundamental time, and spatialized space, non-fundamental space? Who cares? Another thing would be general relativity. General relativity makes a lot of the features that you might have attributed to time, such as whether it's open or closed, dependent on the matter distribution. And so the question sort of seemed to presuppose that there were some features which are intrinsic to time, but now general relativity is making a lot of those features that were intrinsic to time no longer intrinsic to time because it hangs on the matter distribution as well. So for those two reasons, I think the project was sort of abandoned, more or less. But once you identify these problems, you can then see that there's you can answer them and see that there's still a kind of question. You can call it a new question if you like, or the old question reformulated in some way, where you can see that there's still kind of an interesting question. So if you think about the physical motivations first, you know, it's true that there's space-time. Then space-time joins together space and time are no longer fundamental in relativity. But on the other hand, there's still plenty of intrinsic metrical and topological features of relativistic space-times, and some of these features draw sharp and important distinctions between space and time nonetheless. If you look at physics as a whole, then you're not going to find actually that much that's invariant between, truly invariant between spatial and temporal terms. In fact, the only thing I could think of is the one-dimensional wave equation, which is probably the least, it's a nice equation in and of itself, but it's probably the least physically interesting equation you can find. So as I say there, if modern physics is spatializing time as Bergson charged, it's going about the job awfully slowly since, only one equation has been done so far. Now, and also to me, I mean, it just makes the difference that much more fascinating. If there's just space-time and there's not really truly fundamentally space and time, then why is there this difference between time and space? Why are there these important and central distinctions between the two, even in relativity? And then methodology, suggests two changes. One, the data should be scientific, not linguistic. Don't mean to imply linguistics is not science. I just, that's my philosophy of physics prejudice unwittingly coming out. Second, we ought to admit that the goal of previous research may not exist. It may not be the difference between time and space. Okay, but there still could be central and important features of the difference between the two. So what I'm going to do in the talk today is consider this rehabilitated project and propose a kind of novel and I hope interesting distinction between time and space. It's one that I haven't seen before. I also will go off the deep end and actually propose a theory of time at the end. But also, I think along the way, even if you don't like the theory of time that comes up, and if you have anything like a tensed theory of time, and if you like a sort of tensed, flowing sort of theory of time, you'll hate this theory more than anything you've ever hated before in your life. This is the absolute death of time, and it's a completely the most deflationary you can be while still admitting that there's something to be called time. But anyway, even if you hate all of that stuff, you still might find that we're still going to see very interesting connections, I think, along the way between various features that are attributed to time in contemporary physical theories, and it's kind of interesting, I think, to see the relationships between them, especially in the background when you think about in quantum gravity, there's all these people saying, there's no time and things like this, and so I think it's better just to understand what it is we'll be losing if there turns out that there wasn't any time. It turns out that there isn't any time. So the plan is, I'll quickly go through a bunch of other theories. I'll then catalog some of the differences between time and space in contemporary physics. I'll then give the kind of general proposal. I'll then give an illustration. And I put illustration in color there because lots of people mistake the illustration for the general proposal. Reflect carefully on what the word illustration means. It's just an illustration. That's it. It's not the whole theory. The whole theory is in section 3, and then the argument for... Maybe it's because I put 5 after 3. The argument for 3 and 5, well, who knows why it happens. But then I'll give a kind of argument for why you should believe the journal proposal, and then a conclusion, just to take a couple of minutes. What is time? Okay, so other theories. First, obviously, if you have, when I said that there's not that much work on the difference between time and space, that I didn't mean to imply that there's not a lot of work in philosophy of time, and that a lot of that work in philosophy of time has implications for what the difference is between time and space. So if you're a presentist, you believe only the present is real, then you don't believe only the hair is real. That's a difference. If you are Storrs McCall and you believe there's branching going on in the time direction, not in the spatial direction, If you believe time is flowing or passing in some sense, and you don't believe space is flowing or passing in the same sense, then you believe that there's fundamentally a metaphysical difference between time and space. I hate that view. One of my goals in life, apart from one of my non-basketball related goals in life, is to see the utter destruction of that view, of all that whole family of views. I try that on Sunday, so if you, I'm hoping to put the final nail in the coffin of these views on Sunday. So I won't say anything about that now. When I gave this talk before, Tim Maudlin said, "Why do you put all the objections under all three of these views, but none other that?" And I said, "Yeah, you don't even want to get me going on that top one." But anyway, another view would be the old-fashioned causal theory of time. You know, so if you're Leibniz, or more recently Carnap and Reichenbach, Brumbaum, Verfrassen, where you define the earlier than relation in terms of the causal relation, but you don't do that, so there's no spatial counterpart of that, then you would already, at the very basic level, have distinguished time from space in a very important, interesting way. That kind of approach is very much, this kind of approach founders on objections of detail and motivation. So motivation uses all these terms like gen identity and stuff like this, if you remember your Reichenbach, which are not obviously any clearer than the things that were being analyzed. Have we seen in this conference that causation is so such a clear concept that that the earlier than relationship should be defined in terms of our rock solid knowledge of causation? founders on objections of detail, doesn't really work in general relativity. It's hard to come up with hard to do that with general relativity. Then there's sort of the more modern, more metaphysics-y causal theory of time, too, where you can think of Miller and Tooley as defining temporal relations in terms of causal relations. But now the causal relations are not defined in some sort of empiricist-friendly way, the way like Reichenbach did. So remember, Reichenbach had the Mark method and all of this, which was going to elucidate the temporal relation. Here you'd have the causation is going to be a primitive. And, there might be all sorts of other reasons for doing this, but if you're just focusing on the question of the difference between time and space, you think, well, this is not going to be the most interesting answer, because it's going to say, what's the difference between time and space? Time is related to a fundamental, unanalyzable primitive that space is not. Thanks very much. And then there's laws of nature. This is mentioned in passing by Sider, Lower, and then there's a new paper, which we'll talk about, by Scow, where the idea is that the laws of nature single out one dimension over the others in some way. I like this view, more or less. Maybe my view is kind of like a somewhat like it. But again, now if the laws are primitive, then you could say the same sort of things that I just said above about the causal theory of time too. Scow, let's just briefly look at his view. His view is that any direction in which the laws govern the evolution of the world is a time-like direction. So he's defining the difference between time and space in terms of the direction of governance of the laws. The obvious sort of worry he then has to face is, well, what about all these laws which are that could be or are governing in what we would call a space-like direction, right? So he considers toy examples like some law that to the right of every orange is an apple, to the right, to the left of every apple is an orange, and something like that. But I think in the actual physics, you can find laws which seem to be governed in the space, in what we call a space-like direction. When he's considering these sorts of things, he ends up saying, "Well, these things aren't really laws," which is really distasteful to me. It seems to me he's almost defining law via the time-space split as defining the time-space split via law. Because you can think of lots of different cases. So two of Maxwell's equations seem like they're space-like. In the vacuum, the Einstein field equations, the ten vacuum Einstein field equations, six are evolution equations, four are constraint equations on a slice. To say that six of those are laws, the other four are not, because I'm trying to figure out the difference between time and space, seems a bit ad hoc. Still, if there's some way of, you know, rescuing this kind of proposal, I would like that. Okay, so now let's move on to section three. Let's think about the differences between time and space. Like I said, everything but the one-dimensional wave equation, more or less, does distinguish time and space in some way in contemporary physics. Let's label all of those sorts of things, though, the ones that are where the dynamics of the matter fields, matter-energy fields, where the dynamics treats but time and space, where the dynamics of those fields are differently related to time than to space. Let's just lump all those under dynamics. And then if we consider then space-time features, we can then look at a bunch of properties that time has in space-time. We can look at a bunch of features that space has in space-time. And what we'd want to do is sort of factor out the ones that both space and time have, you know, so that they might have a lot of topological properties in common. They might both be Hausdorff. They might both be orientable, etc. And so when you look through, you know, you can find, maybe somebody else could find more, but when I look through, you know, inspection leads to, you know, four major differences you see. One is this dynamical distinction. Another one is that you find a lot of equations which are not time reversal invariant, but parity reversal invariant in physics. Another one is the famous minus sign in the metric of relativity, but also in classical physics. And then, of course, the dimensionality, one dimension of time, more than one dimension of space. So let's go through these quickly, and let me just see what... Yeah, let me go through very, very quickly so we can get to the punchline. Let's look at the metrical difference. The metrical structure of space-time is arguably its most central and important feature. It gives all the distances between all the different events in space-time, which is going to give all the, you know, the angles. All the structure is going to come from the metric, more or less. If you even in classical physics, if you put it all into space-time physics like Cartan did, if you consider Newton-Cartan space-time, even there, there's a distinction between time and space and the metrics. So you have two metrics. There's one, the two degenerate metrics, one for time, one for space. And in relativity, you famously have one. So Reichenbach makes a big deal of this. So here's a quote from Reichenbach. He says, "The world of Minkowski expresses the peculiarity of the time dimension mathematically by prefixing a minus sign to the time expression in the basic metrical formula." If you haven't done any physics for a long time or ever, and you think you don't know what a metric is, you do know what a metric is. Just think of something like the Pythagorean theorem, right? That's giving you a metric between the hypotenuse is given, you're given the distance between those two points in the triangle in terms of the sides. And you can think of, relativity is, special relativity is giving an alternative metric. General relativity is positing a whole bunch of other allowable ones. And notice that if you look at, say, the Lorentzian metric in Minkowski space-time, you can see that if I, x1, it's got a plus, there's a plus in front, x2, there's a plus in front, x3, there's a plus in front, x4, there's a minus in front. Why is that? Why is there this minus in front? So this is what Reichenbach is pointing to when he talks about expressing the peculiarity of the time dimension. For him, it really was, because he had the causal theory of time from which he was deriving, from his Mark method and a bunch of other assumptions, he was deriving the Lorentzian structure of the world. So he sees the minus sign as reflecting his causal theory of time in some ways. Now, you might say, well, okay, this distinction is really not so important because, you could get rid of it with a coordinate transformation. So, string theorists use light cone coordinates where you let tau equals icx4, and that will get rid of the minus sign, or you could just let, tau equals minus x4. And it's conventional whether you go plus, 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 or minus, minus, minus in the metric here. And for these reasons, Scow discounts the importance of this feature. I think it is important. I'm not sure if Scow would disagree with this, but the signature of the metric is a geometrical invariant. So the signature is this sort of plus, 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 minus. So given G, the metric, you can find an orthonormal basis of the tangent space at each point E on the manifold M, You let the number of basic vectors with the unit product of v with itself be that are plus 1 be p, and the number that are minus 1 be q. In relativity, you assume the metric's not degenerate, and so you don't. So it's just the p's and the q's. So you can prove that the metric is the signature is an invariant if you assume that the manifold is connected and g is non-degenerate and continuous, which you do in fact. Assume. So it's not just a coordinate feature. I mean, you can change things around with the coordinate with the coordinate. So you can change the way it looks, but you're not changing the ultimate geometrical picture there. So just some terminology. So we have so there are positive definite metrics or manifolds. These will be ones that are all pluses and or all minuses. And Lorentzian manifolds, which will be ones where one dimension will stick out, so they'll either be so if the dimensionality of the manifold is n, then n minus 1, 1, or 1, n minus 1. As you probably know, in relativity, you also have the distinction between you can take the inner product of the with respect to the metric of some vector, and you can call it either space-like, time-like, or null-like, depending on whether the inner product is positive, negative, or zero. I put little stars there because whenever I'm going to use time-like and space-like in this sense, I'm going to have the star there because I don't want to conflate it with the sense of time-like I'm going to end up coming up with. So right now it's going to be an open question about whether the time-like I come up with coincides with this time-like. Let's skip this. Dimensionality. So there's one dimension of time, more than one dimension of space. Let me skip this. There's a little kind of issue here, and I should say for clarification that because it's not clear when you have relativity that there's not the set of instants where you can just go and grab that set of instants and look at the topological dimension of this because it varies with inertial frame and relativity. In classical spacetime, you can just grab that set of instants and then just look at its dimensionality. So there are other ways of understanding the dimensionality here. And so for that reason, I'm going to use the words the temporal directions versus the spatial directions as opposed to the temporal dimensions versus the spatial dimensions. Okay. So when I say that, though, don't think I'm talking about the earlier than, later than, the past future directions. That's not the subject of this talk at all. I'm talking about the spatial versus temporal directions. So I'm always thinking of the time-space split, never the past-future split. Okay. One thing I did want to mention was that in speculative physics and philosophy, there are models with more than one time dimension, and Steve will talk about these on Sunday. And so you might know in philosophy there are all these talks, papers by Thompson and McBeath where you consider scenarios where in one of them there's Zoe and her friends, I forget how exactly all this goes. They live in terms of, with respect to, I forget the name of the other group, but say Andre and his friends, they live fast and hard, and they pack in twice as much life in Andre's sort of way of looking at things. And so they live, they do everything that Andre does, but they do it in 40 years, and it takes Andre and his friends 80 years. But from Zoe and her friends' point of view, Andre and her friends and his friends are packing in life hard, and they carve everything up in terms of what McBeath calls yonks, they live only 40 yonks, but it takes 80 yonks for Andre and his friends to pack in that much life. And McBeath says, in this sort of thought experiment, then it makes sense to say that there's two time dimensions. But notice that there is pressure. All I want to point out here is that there's pressure against doing this sort of thing in science. And what I want to point out is that actually McBeath's thought experiment is isomorphic to the situation where you have mesons entering the atmosphere. They're living more, they're living longer than they should, right? If you think about, some relativity. But yet science sticks with one time. And in fact, you can look at, you know, physics breaks, you know, all hell breaks loose with physics with more than one time dimension. Here, hell strictly means stability problems in this cute little argument from Dorling, causality and probability violations, even observable causality and probability violations. In Duran, not the Tour de France five-time winner, but the physicist proves that, you know, if you have a extra time-like dimension that's you know, this 1/100, 1/10 the Planck radius, then that's going to cause observable problems. Okay, directionality. I'm going to just ignore directionality. So this is the past-future distinction. I think of it as a feature not of space-time itself, but rather of the processes in space-time. And so I would lump this more in with the dynamics. I think it's better if I just... but notice that if you object to this, notice you shouldn't object to me ignoring this, because I'm going to say I can pull out the distinction between time and space without resorting to the earlier than later than direction. If the earlier than later than direction is really dear to you, then, you know, I'd be happy to use that too. It would just make the job that much easier. And then the matter field. So if you look at, say, Klein-Gordon equation, you see that the one called T there is a different sign than the ones with the X, Y, Z. Okay, now we come to my theory. Okay, so this is the general theory, not the illustration. And the general idea is this. I should say there's motivation. So there's motivation from a particular theory of laws of nature I like. So remember, I was leaving off before at the beginning where we were talking about the laws of nature. I said I would like that approach if I could make sense of it. Here's a way to try to make sense of it. And I would want it to be a kind of empiricist theory of laws, because otherwise I might end up just positing a primitive distinction between time and space. So it'd be more edifying, I think, if we could find an empiricist system of laws. Empiricist system of laws that I think is the best one around is this one by David Lewis. But now notice, all this motivation could just be completely discarded, and you can just like my theory, even if you hate this theory of laws. But if you like this theory of laws, or you even have a little bit of, you know, wake up in the night and you think, I might like it, this will give you extra motivation. It's a little bit, you know, it's an extra push. But the theory itself is so beautiful and elegant, you don't need that extra push. But maybe you do. So all of this can be ignored. So you could go to sleep and come back for the theory and forget about the motivation. On Lewis's theory of laws, you consider the various deductive systems, each of which makes only true claims about what exists. The best system is the deductive system that best balances simplicity and strength, and if probabilistic, also fit. Simplicity is measured with respect to a language that contains a primitive predicate for each natural property. Strength is informativeness about matters of particular fact. If you were God the programmer, and you're going to write down you could write down a program which just listed every single fact, so it'd be a very long program and would not be very simple. On the other hand, you could just write down something really simple, such as like anything goes, and everything will follow from that. Everything will be consistent with that, but it won't be very strong. So you can see strength and simplicity battling each other. And the hope, you know, among Mill Ramsey Lewis partisans is that in this internal battle between simplicity and strength, something like F equals ma will pop out, whatever the best laws are. So the laws of nature here are really the best systematizers of things. Now, Lower connects this stuff up in an unpublished paper with time, and this is all he says, it's just kind of offhand, but he says, in fact, one might go so far as to say that what distinguishes the temporal dimension from the spatial ones is the dimension picked out by the best theory for special treatment. In other words, the distribution of fundamental properties is laid out in space-time in such a way that the theory that best combines simplicity and informativeness picks one of these dimensions for writing down equations that informatively describe that distribution. These remarks need more development and defense, especially in view of relativistic conceptions of space-time. then, he should be then, I will get into it here, but it's suggestive of the constructive potential of Lewis's conception of laws. So that's the kind of picture I want to have here. If we just want to take a kind of toy example to help motivate the idea, you know, if all the stuff in the world just occupied this green line and you had two dimensions, you know, it'd be hard to say, you know, x1, that's time, x0, that's space. You know, you wouldn't really have any, the best system of law of that world would just say there's the stuff in it goes in a straight line, and that's that. You probably wouldn't have any reason to pick out it's just the stuff, the distribution of stuff in the world wouldn't pick out x1 over x0. Suppose you had a world, you know, that was like an expanding Friedman, Robinson, Walker model. We have the cosmological, where, you know, it's often said the cosmological principle holds. So at each slice, so you could carve up. So you look at the world as a four-dimensional whole, and we notice there's a certain carving where the slices on those carving are each isotropic. The stuff is isotropic and homogeneous. But it's not like what we might call the perfect cosmological principle is true, where you could do that for all the different ways even. And so you could see there, one direction is picked out, is sort of distinguished by the by the very stuff, plus your ability, your wanting to systematize it. Okay, so. This idea is kind of vague, in need of development. The Milne-Ramsey-Lewis theory itself, you know, notoriously suffers from problems of murkiness about what the heck simplicity and strength mean and things like that. And it's not clear, as Barry mentions, that how it all translates into the contemporary setting. But nonetheless, I like the idea. Arguably, the answers are a question without resort to a primitive. The half about simplicity already fits with an attractive view about time. So if you go to like your Meisner, Thorne, and Wheeler gravitation book, you know, there's that big section about time as the great simplifier. And if you read your Poincaré, there's all this stuff about why don't you use some pendulum on some guy's boat as the arbiter of true time? Because then, the sun will have to speed up. When you develop your system of the world, the sun will have to speed up and slow down as the guy's going from the North Pole to the equator because of the pendulum thing. You'd have to explain that and then think of how horrible and complicated the physics would be. It gives you a headache just thinking about it. So time is the great simplifier. This is a kind of point that Poincaré, Reichenbach, Barber all point out. This fits in already, the sort of time being simple, time and now time being strong, informative. Simplicity by itself won't pick out the time versus space business because space is the great simplifier as well, if you think about it. So that's some motivation. Like I say here, nothing in what follows hangs on assuming the Milne-Ramsey-Lewis laws, although I will speak as if I'll still continue to talk in those terms. Here's the theory. General idea is that time is that direction on a space-time manifold. So I'm not going to be smuggling in time anywhere. So if you see it, sometimes it slips. So space-time manifold, you just cross out space-time if you want. Time is the direction on a manifold in which we can tell the strongest stories. Strongest, i.e. most informative. So suppose you have an n-dimensional manifold. Notice that m, so m is the differential manifold, and g is the metric on m. So if you were going with the Milne-Ramsey-Lewis stuff, you would think, well, I've got all the distribution of properties, I've got all the events, and then my Poincaré or whatever simplicity and strength and stuff helps me to determine a metric. I now have the manifold and that metric. Now I'm looking to see which way do I carve up that thing to find out which direction is the which way does we've got the time-space split. Okay, so I'm looking which way to do it. Go to a picture. So here we are. So here's the game. So here's the world. There are all the events of the world. Pretty. Which way do I carve it up to get time? Well, I could carve it up this way, and it's going to be a certain amount of strength. Carve it up this way, it's going to be a certain amount of strength. I tell you, you want maximum strength, and whenever you have maximum strength, that direction is going to be the direction of time. not the direction of time again in the earlier later than sense, but the direction of time versus the direction of space. Or a direction, I should say. So the proposal is a temporal direction at point P on structure, MG, is that direction in which the best theory tells the strongest, i.e. most informative story. The set of all these directions is the temporal direction. In terms of the MRL theory, time is the strongest direction of the already on balance strongest and simplest theory. And again, to avoid terminological models, remember there's no reason at this stage to think that time-like defined here has anything to do with time-like in the asterisk sense from relativity. Okay, a priori, there's no reason to think that the direction of strength will go, well, that time, that the direction of strength, that time will march in the direction of strength in this up the a Lorentzian manifold in the minus direction, a priori. In fact, you might wonder, why is it that time is always being associated with the minus direction on Lorentzian manifolds? So this is one of the sort of sub-puzzles that I hope get elucidated here. So everyone gets the basic picture of the game? I'm not going to have time for this, I don't think, but another way, you can see another way, kind of direct, another connection, where you could say time is that direction in which we can get as much determinism as possible. Okay, but let me not go into that. There are lots of complications and stuff. Notice none of this, I'm not in any way committed to determinism. Determinism is definitely not a matter for armchair reflection, although it might be a regulative ideal. What's crucial to understanding how the theory works is distinguishing between marks of strength and real overall strength. So we're looking at the best system. So we're not looking at any particular law. We're looking at the best system of all the laws, of the best system of laws. And no one feature like determinism, or if it's probabilistic theory, you could think of another sign of strength as being Markovian. You know, if you could forget the past, that's great strength for your theory. So there's all these different marks of strength, but no one of them is sort of the automatic guarantee that that's the direction of strength, because it might be deterministic over some small domain and indeterministic over a larger domain. The indeterminism might trump in some sense, might be more informative in some sense than determinism. And so I don't want to. I'm not putting anything on. I'm not identifying some mark of strength and identifying that as the, sort of the be all and end all of strength. Okay. So, as it is, I love the theory, but what would be really nice is if you could actually, what I've always wanted to do with the Mill-Ramsey-Lewis theory of laws anyway was just to have a kind of toy world where you actually had the distribution of natural properties laid out and, then had some kind of computer program, have some sort of real definite, sense of simplicity and sense of strength and, see if you could just actually find out what the laws were from this. Well, you could sort of do that here, as it turns out, and so here we go to the illustration. So we're going to, the illustration is supposed to be kind of extra motivation for believing the theory. And the illustration is wonderful for the general theory. So what I want to do with the illustration is I'm going to restrict myself to a certain class of phenomena, a certain class of equations. Okay, so, and I'm going to restrict myself to a certain definite sense of what I mean by strength. So I'm not going to have any kind of murky notion of strength. I'm going to tell you exactly what I mean by strength. I'm going to tell you exactly the sort of the domain of the sorts of things I'm going to look at, of the sorts of worlds I'm going to look at. And of course, the illustration's the more interesting if it's not restricted to some very particular sorts of worlds. And so I've got the restriction is to laws that are linear second order partial differential equations. So that is laws of this form where you have their derivatives. Aij is the matrix, bi is a vector, c a scalar, u is the solution. As it happens, tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of physics can be put into this form. Tons. I just can't express how many things in physics can be put in this form. Tons. I mean, so you get some indication there. But it really is the dot, dot, dot that gives you even the more. So it's just tons and tons and tons. So unfortunately, not everything. So there was a brief moment where I flirted with thinking I had everything, and I just, you know, deleted the whole general proposal and went crazy with then the illustration wasn't an illustration, it was the theory. Anyway, now what do I mean? So that's the class, so I'm going to restrict myself to this domain. What do I mean by strength? Here's what I mean by strength. Well-posed Cauchy problem. This is the ultimate in strength that you can conceive of. The human mind cannot conceive of being stronger than this. This is as good as it gets. What is a well-posed Cauchy problem? Basically, it's a deterministic theory, a theory that's deterministic, plus having continuous dependence on initial data. What's going to be crucial here, right, is that do not put any kind of temporal notions in. Often when you express this stuff, you know, there are temporal notions in there. Anyway, so what you have is a partial differential equation defined over a domain, supplemented by initial boundary conditions. And it's well posed if basically there's a solution. So that's obviously what, you know, something you want. And the solution's unique. So that's determinism. So if you have a unique solution, that gives you determinism. You know, so given some data, you then can get a unique solution. That's really strong, right? Because you then have, you know, you're ruling out all these other possible worlds, all of them but one. And then the solution depends continuously on the data according to some suitable topology. There are reasons for wanting three, but I'll talk about those in a second. So now there are three, people talk about three different types of boundary conditions. They're a conjunction, a linear combination of U and its normal, you know, think of perpendicular derivative on the boundary. It's Cauchy or mixed is one where you have, you know, U and its derivative, you know, and its normal derivative. Usually it's called mixed if it's, you know, in the if the stuff is on the put on a time-like surface, but we don't want to rule those guys out just by, you know, name, so we want to include those sorts of guys because we don't want to put in the time space split at the beginning. We want it to come out. So what we're going to see is that time is going to merge from this theory like a rabbit out of a hat, except it won't really have a rabbit and a false bottom like a true magic trick. There really just won't be any time there in the hat. So motivation for why would you want something well posed? Let me just go quickly here. I mean, the idea is, you know, if you if it's not well posed, then the you know, rounding off errors, perturbations, all sorts of noise. You know, when you're doing experiments and stuff, you're not looking at your values out to you know, 10,000 decimal places. And if it's not there's not continuous dependence, then you know. Some little small bit of noise or something might imply a vastly distinct solution. So you're worried about some satellite going somewhere, and you haven't calculated out to the 10,000th place, but it turns out that, you know, that the 10,000th place means the satellite you know, goes to Jupiter instead of Mars. Well, that would be bad. So what you want is strength. So it's motivating in a way. If you want strength in the sense of Ehrman as opposed to Lewis, if you know this literature. So Ehrman talks about strength in application, strength for us as opposed to strength in the sort of Platonic sense. And so for these reasons, you would want well-posed Cauchy problems. I don't want to say... you know, so they're good things. I don't want to make too much of it because it's just the illustration. But there are, seem to be obviously good things. Now, let me see what time it is. Oop. Okay, I better really speed up here. Okay, so here's the claim now for the illustration. For systems governed by equations one, a temporal direction at point P of n-dimensional mg. Is that direction normal to the n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface intersecting P upon which Cauchy data can be prescribed to obtain a well-posed Cauchy problem? In other words, well-posed Cauchy problems pick out time. So if we were playing that game where we had all those all those flashes of events, and I'm asking you, and I say, you want a well-posed Cauchy problem, you know, so that's going to tell you which way you can slice things up. And the theory had better, if it's going to be plausible, that way had better have lots of features that we usually associate with time. Okay. Here's a quick sketch of the argument. Equations of type 1 up there can be hyperbolic, elliptic, parabolic, and ultra-hyperbolic, depending upon the number of positive and negative eigenvalues in AIG, J. Notice that everything I'm going to say here, what I just said, and everything to follow is all going to be coordinate invariant. So just changing coordinates isn't going to change anything. And so you have your standard classification from partial differential equations of these sorts of things in terms of their positive and number negative eigenvalues. So you see the wave equation, the heat equation, the Laplace equation over there. Now, what I'm going to make use of is the fact that is something that Tegmark, string theorist, makes use of, and that is making use of a claim in Courant and Hilbert. And that is, with Cauchy data on non-closed hypersurfaces, elliptic and parabolic equations do not admit well-posed Cauchy problems. So if I'm telling you you want a well-posed Cauchy problem, you're not going to do it with the elliptic and parabolic. The elliptic suffer a variety of fates, non-unique solutions, lack of existence, lack of continuity. Parabolic equations have too many solutions given the Cauchy data. That leaves hyperbolic and ultra-hyperbolic. But now these theories are very finicky. There's a result, from Asgeirsson's mean value theorem, many, many corollaries from that imply that the data had better be what is better be put on a space-like slice if you're going to get a well-posed Cauchy problem. What do we mean by space-like there? Well, I better not be importing this time-space split. But I can put it in, but I don't need to. I'll show in a toy example how you can think about it. So I'm going to have a very definite sense of what I mean by space-like and time-like, which doesn't incorporate any of our time and space in at any moment. So you could think, here's one way to think about it. So for hyperbolic equations, there are these, the partial differential equation implies all this kind of structure on in the solution space, and it'll divide. It'll have these what are they called characteristic conoids, which consist of two sheets emanating from each point of the n-dimensional space. The sheets divide the space into three disjoint regions. Call surface elements at the vertex of these three regions space-like if they lie in the region bounded by both sheets, and time-like if they point into one of the two regions bounded by a single sheet. So there, I haven't imported any kind of time in there. Okay, so that's what's crucial. Now, Asgeirsson's theorem is going to imply that only hyperbolic equations with Cauchy data on space-like surfaces give rise to well-posed Cauchy problems. So now and then, are there any? In fact, it turns out there's a theorem that there's tons of them. Okay, so all linear hyperbolic second-order systems have well-posed Cauchy problems if data is so specified. Intuitively, the PDE is implying these geometrical structures called characteristics. And now you can imagine drawing. I'm going to draw various things, so it might be slices of time. There's one on the left, blue, and there's one on the right. If I drew the one on the left and I want to I'm not going to get a well-posed Cauchy problem because the information at Q, the value of the solution at Q is going to be influenced by the value I put there on the initial slice, but also it's going to be constrained by its value at P, which is going to be carried along by the characteristics. Whereas in the other case, things will be nice. Well, here's a toy example in with a wave equation. Whoa. Consider an arbitrary curve in a point P not on C. Prescribe data on curve C. If we have a solution U of P, so you have a solution up there at top of P, there'll be characteristic curves intersecting P and C at points Q and R of C. So if I have a solution P, I can trace back these characteristic curves that will intersect somewhere on C. The solution UP will then be determined by the solution and its derivative within the triangle created by QP, PR, and QR. In this case, we could define the space-like as, what do we mean by space-like? We mean as P tends to a point on C, so as I bring P down towards C, the points Q and R also tend to that point on C. Notice I'm not importing anything temporal here. This is why it's a rabbit coming out of a hat. It's just there's nothing temporal there. And then I then find out from the argument I just gave that UP is consistent with Cauchy data on C only if C is space-like in that sense. And then now I just need to show that space-like in that sense corresponds to space like we think of space and time like we think of time, and then the rabbit is successfully pulled out of the hat. Well, here's a couple of facts. The Cauchy surface that I put the data on must be n minus one dimensional. If you do put it on anything less, then you won't get a well-posed Cauchy problem. So the direction orthogonal to that has to be one-dimensional. So it's forced to be one-dimensional. Great. Also, the signature of space-time is connected to the type of equation if fundamental. For covariant field equations, the matrix Aij in the PDEs I'm considering will have the same eigenvalues as the metric tensor. So you take something like the Klein-Gordon equation there. If I just switch one of those signs, it's going to it has a well-posed Cauchy problem. If I switch one of the signs and it goes Laplacian, if I put a minus in front of the T one and it goes Laplacian, then it's not going to be well-posed anymore. So you have a connection then to the Lorentzianness of the world. And then, should be obvious if you know some physics, I won't even explain this. This sense of time-like is just going to be the sense of time-like that you have in relativity. And as much as this sense of time-like you have in relativity connects up with our concept of time, which it does, then we have our connection to our conception of time. So the Cauchy data must be placed on the plus 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 submanifold of the Lorentzian manifold and pushed forward into the negative dimension, direction. So that's wonderful. So like I just said, all of this corresponds well with the temporal directions in physics, and we have all these nice connections between them. Let me leave this. So we're not going to have that much time. I think I'm coming. Oh yes, only 5 more minutes. So we can just leave all these nasty objections and stuff for later. Maybe they won't come up. So is this illustration merely a mathematical curiosity? Well, in some sense, yes. Tegmark makes a big deal of it and says it and has this sort of anthropomorphic explanation of the one-dimensionality of time. It's not general enough to cover all of physics, this stuff. But on the other hand, I do think it is real motivation for the general view, because you can perturb it a little bit, and it still tells you things about the time-space split. And also, you could look at other things, like there's this big, huge paper by Garrosh in 96, where the time-space split, where he considers first-order differential partial PDEs, which he says it can govern almost every system of physical interest if you just sort of add fields here and there. And one of the conditions for getting unique existence is a time-space split. And so in his theory, a time-space split is a piece of a sufficient condition for unique existence. That's not as good as what I have here in the illustration, where I show it's really necessary and sufficient. But it still has connections. So we go now back away from the general argument. We go back to the general, away from the illustration, back to the general argument. So now I ask, should we believe the general claim? Now we've had two separate motivations, one the illustration, one the Milne-Ramsey-Lewis stuff. Well, in a sense of against, you might think, for goodness sake, Craig, how do you know what is the direction of overall best direction of strength in the world? I mean, look at all the, there are signs on certain streets that tell you about what's happening on other streets at that time. You might say, parade today, and it tells you about a parade over there. There's all these spatial constraints and stuff, laws like I mentioned before when I was criticizing Scow. And all of that stuff, people sometimes say thermodynamics should really have been called thermostatics because there's no T in thermodynamics. Well, there's a T, but there's a capital T, and it's temperature, but not time. There are all these other well-posed problems, Dirichlet and Neumann problems, which are ones where you have either just the derivative or the or just the solution but not both? Do I have access to some overall metric of strength covering everything? Heck no. I was going to write hell no, but I was doing this in the kitchen, and one of my kids was going by, and my wife has set up a jar where I have to put money in where whenever the kids catch me swearing. And I didn't know if typing counted as... I didn't want to get into all of that. What is my answer to this? I don't have some sort of access to some overall metric of strength covering everything in the world. Of course I don't. But if we restrict matters to fundamental physics in worlds like ours, then the answer is absolutely clear. It's absolutely lopsided, the direction of strength, when it comes to fundamental physics between one direction and the others. So look at Newtonian mechanics. Well, as you know, there are all these counterexamples, Bézier and stuff. It's not perfectly deterministic. But hell, it's really close to deterministic. And there are all these proofs by Sari and stuff that, you know, for in different dimension, different numbers of particles, that for almost all initial conditions deterministic and stuff. Quantum mechanics is deterministic if we could put aside the all that measurement business. General relativity was a smattering of results, but there are lots of global existence in well-posed Cauchy problems for general relativity. There are none in what we would consider the space-like direction. There are some in the time-like direction. Actually, I could talk more about that because I've had a long discussion with Garrosh about this, where he has come up with some sideways well-posed Cauchy problems. They're much more complicated than the regular ones, so it still fits in with my picture here. So in all of these, strength is overwhelmingly dominant in one direction. So we should believe it. So if you're given information about on Fifth Avenue about what happens on Fourth and Sixth, well, who knows whether you're getting more, whether you can get more information when we consider all, you know, the economics. We want to ask a question about the economics of Sixth Avenue versus given the economics of Fifth Avenue. Well, I don't know if we're going to get more than that, more information that way or less information that way than if we consider, you know, the time evolution from the information on Fifth Avenue. But I do know that if you just give me the fundamental properties, the fundamental physical properties of any theory remotely like the ones we have, then I will get a lot more information on the right-hand side than on the left-hand side. Okay, so we should believe it. It has lots of virtues. Fits beautifully with the Miller-Ramsey-Lewis theory. Explains the difference between time and space in terms of the distribution of fundamental properties, not some primitive. Explains the one-dimensionality of time, and to the extent that the illustration is relevant, also the Lorentzianness of it. Doesn't prohibit laws holding across space like hypersurfaces, like Scow's view. And you can get other aspects of time, too. You know, we could build it if the past-future asymmetry is law-like. We could build some of this stuff in. There's an interesting book in French by Lautmann, who is a member of the French Resistance and died, but he's a philosopher of math, and which he says you can get the parameter aspects of time versus the coordinate aspects of time from the structure of PDEs. So all of this, despite my caution at the beginning, makes me think, is this the difference between space and time? Okay, so putting it all together. And now finally, I'm over time, but I just want to turn to one tiny wee little question, which is the nature of time. What is time? It's been a question asked for millennia, and it turns out it can be answered in about 30 seconds. So there's St. Augustine, what is time? Now, all I've done is I pointed out the difference between two things. But pointing out the difference between two things doesn't say what the thing is. So this is an extra, this doesn't follow from the theory in any way. It's just a kind of extra tempting speculation. So, you know, Hugh and I are different. His knee problems are due to rollerblading, whereas my knee problems are due to basketball. But, you know, we're also featherless bipeds, with some of them with shoulder problems also from basketball and things like that. So it doesn't say, it doesn't imply what thing is. But on the other hand, like I say here, it's tempting to say, call MG, the manifold plus the metric space, the whole four, five, whatever, you know, string theories, right, whatever, however many dimensions it is, call that big thing, the arena of all events, space. What is time? Well, time is just the most informative direction on that manifold. So it is whatever space is. So if, Leibniz is right and relationalism about space is right, then relationalism is right about time. if Newton's right and it's a substance, then you know that, then it's a substance. But whatever it is, whatever it turns out to be the right theory of space, time just is space, but it's just a direction of space which is preferred by strength. And so it's a combination of the distribution of matter fields and stuff, plus beings like us being such that we find strength in a certain way. Notice what's interesting here is that if strength is defined platonically, then the time-space split is perfectly objective. If not, if it's sort of more the view I was liking, if it's strength and application for beings like us, then the difference between space and time, and hence time itself, partly depends on beings like us. And that's where the intervention stuff, it kind of fits in a way. And why, if you think about, you know, causation in terms of, you know, as being peculiarly temporal, if this view is right, then at least some aspect of the causal asymmetry is, and if that second part is right, then at least some aspect of the causal asymmetry is due to us, because time is. And that's it. Yeah, not in the picture here.
So, yes. Yeah, hi. Great.
Yeah.
I think maybe I feel it might be overreaching with because I was with you in the previous slide that this is an analysis of time for worlds like ours. Okay, so these are very specific worlds that have hyperbolic differential equation, well-posed Cauchy problem in one direction. And I'm sympathetic to the idea that
no, but that's the illustration. But the illustration, remember, was bolded in red, and illustration means illustration. Doesn't have to. I mean, so you could consider the special, whatever the direction of strength is.
I don't think it works.
It doesn't have to be hyperbolic,
right?
Suppose the world was governed by a fundamentally elliptic equation or something, or some kind of steady state thing. You know, maybe you would find strength in some other mark of strength.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, for one thing, you're considering it's hard to figure out exactly what an answer to this question, to Augustine's question, is going to look like. I mean, what class of worlds? So you're considering worlds that have at least our space time. Okay, so you have a manifold with a metric and signature. You might consider worlds that are not describable in that way. Even Newtonian worlds don't have a metric in the same way. We're talking about the space-time metric. But even if you take a Minkowski space-time, you consider kinds of laws which are stipulative, which divorce the background behavior. Okay, and not the background behavior, the background structure of the metric and behavior of the matter on the metric. So I can take a Minkowski space-time and take a surface which is split in the time and space dimension, so in two dimensions, it's just say a vertical line. Give you data on that surface, and say, well, the world evolves in a deterministic way in the space-time direction. Okay, so it stipulates some laws whereby basically the initial data on any surface dictate future and past behavior, the future and past of space length with respect to the background. Now there, I mean, I would imagine you would say, well, the signature of the metric becomes irrelevant, that what time is has nothing to do with the signature. Time is now going to be, you know, to the right, the right and left, that's forward and backward time. I'm not sure. You're not yet, so I guess you're sympathetic to that. So the one issue there, the smaller issue, is what connection does the background structure of the, what we call the space-time, have to do with the structure that you pick out? And the other is just how general analysis is this of the nature of time.
Right, good. Okay. I guess maybe I should, I mean, for the general proposal, maybe I shouldn't even say, you know, manifold and metric. I mean, I just say whatever the distribution, you know, just the Humean mosaic, whatever it's on, whatever space it's on. and not be so particular about whether it's manifold. I mean, you know, maybe Isom's right and it's not a manifold, or, you know, but I don't see that, for the general claim, I don't see why any of that should matter when really what I want is just the strongest direction on the, whatever the fundamental structure, you know, whatever the, of the fundamental natural properties. So I think you're right. I shouldn't tie it, you know, put it all on manifold and metric. Really, I should just say whatever the, you know, the fundamental arena of events is. That's good. And yeah, so then you can also see. I mean, so I'm, of course, I mean, part of the motivation of this was actually coming from general relativity, where there is no neat division between background and non-background, and it depends what you mean by background and stuff. And you know, so I want it to be, you know, neutral with respect to whether, you know, it's a general relativistic world or not. And you know, definitely you see the, I mean, if you look, you know, there are all these well-posed Cauchy problems in general relativity too, even though there's, you know, not that division. And there's definitely, I would say, an asymmetry of strength there, to be found there too, without a kind of background independence. Now, as far as worlds like ours, yeah, definitely I'm thinking, I don't know, to even use the word, but, you know, sort of naturalistically. So I'm trying to imagine, you know, worlds in, you know, Lewis's inner sphere. Can you, now if we consider this question, what is time? Well, yeah, I mean, here I am overreaching. I mean, in the paper, I think I'm clear where you can think of tons of different features of time, right? And you can imagine worlds where, you know, so I think in the paper, I describe about five different features of time. So you can imagine the direction of strength is good. Imagine you have a manifold with three signature. So three pluses, three minuses. So there's not one dimension of time or in the rest. And you know, you've got a sort of a past future asymmetry along, you know, x1. You've got the direction of strength along x2. You've got all these different features you can imagine along each one. So you could just take, sort of cluster concept of time, take all your favorite features you attribute to time, and put just one and only one of those on each of the dimensions. And so you just completely have now sort of obliterated your, if you imagine a world where you've just completely, where maybe, you know, maybe world lines don't persist of objects in the one along, so you can imagine all these different sorts of things. Now, I think that in worlds like ours, all of these things will hang together. That's hard to imagine why you would come up with a physics where, say, you wouldn't have persistent world lines, and yet you would have strength. It's hard to imagine how you could have strength without persistent world lines of something. And so you can think of all the. So you think as you get closer and closer to our world, those different features will hang together more. And if that's right, then. You know, the sort of all the counterexamples you can imagine. So I can imagine tons of counterexamples where the direction of strength is going in a different direction, is, you know, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, and whatnot. Where all of those are then sufficiently outside the world, you know, sufficiently weird that you would then want to say that. Just like Mill Ramsey Lewis people are always saying anyway about, you know, very simple worlds where the laws would be different and stuff like that. So you'd have that same kind of move, but with time.
So this is a two-part question, both parts of which are extremely naive. First part is it a consequence of your view that if the distribution of matter into distant portions of the universe from us, our distribution of properties or whatever your human mosaic is built out of, if that distribution were different than the time dimension, the time split, the pace times, but would be different. So if you, so is it a consequence of your view that if we sort of muck around the property distribution, sort of, you know, well beyond anywhere where we are, that can change which dimension is time? And then the second part is, does that bother you? If that's right, that, you know, we could, you know, potentially if things like well beyond where we are, we're different than, you know. this could be time, and we could be sort of living frozen. And
I don't know if it bothers me. I guess it could happen. You know that you. What would be happening is you would think that, you know, the local, the best system you would find locally would not agree with the best system. So that's what, really what you're imagining. So then we would find, you know, locally the physics is such that it would pick out, you know, time going this way, the time space split going this way. But really, you know, if we knew the full everything that happens, we would have picked up a, you know, there would have been a bit different best system, and actually our the time space split would be different than what we think. But that's, you know,
there's an intuition that one might have that the time space split should be intrinsic to a region, and using best systems is going to make the time space split holistic, extrinsic to any given region determined by the global times. So I'm wondering if you share the intrinsicness intuition at all, if you're happy.
No, I mean. I mean, I defined it. I mean, I defined it at a point, but it is holistic in the sense. But I mean, it's all, you know, it's like the Humean laws and stuff are going to be holistic, right? So it's all good. It's good. So time is going to share all of those kinds of features that laws are in that way. The other part was, do I care? And the answer was no.
If I can award myself a finger on that, sometimes the compromise between holism and immediate locality is to have a continuity condition. So just because the laws are more than defined at a point doesn't necessarily mean you have to totally disagree with Jonathan's point. You could say that it's defined holistically but constrained to be continuous between... Sorry, you could say it's not defined holistically, but it's constrained to be continuous over... the whole manifold or something. I mean, just that there's some options there.
Another kind of another kind of thing where you might get a mismatch of arrows would be, you know, if the second part is right, you know, if it's relative to the natural kind choice, and then, you know, Martian scientists carve up the world differently so that, you know, this flows to there. You know, and so you have a conflict between our arrows.
Here. Sorry, Janan.
You alluded actually to what I was going to ask, which was to what extent does this actually depend on some restrict the measurements of simple strength strain that restriction
happens? Can you speak up?
I'm just asking to what extent the measurement, all of this depends on some restrictional properties. And in particular, I mean, my speculation is all you mean is measurability.
This is a big question, and so the question is, you know, so, well, I don't know, I can put the question in a kind of nasty way toward me, which would be, I mean, the worst thing you could say, right, would be, the worst thing that could happen for this view would be, so my choice of natural properties, if the natural choice of natural properties already has a time-space split in it. Actually seems to me plausible. So why do I pick, protons and stuff? They're the things that are going to persist in the... I don't know why vertical is the time direction, but... And this is a kind of problem that bothers me about the Mill-Ramsey-Lewis picture itself, that, you know, can't consider simplicity between two different systems which have different natural kinds, sets of natural kinds, which is a real problem. So different ways of trying to answer that worry. So you might go with Barry Taylor has that sort of T-cozy stuff where you could have it all relative to a theory, and you're not picking out, like Lewis did, natural properties once and for all in some metaphysically distinguished way. So you could imagine, so this whole view, you know, varies with the way you consider that view. So if you want to say it's all, so I don't mind, so if you could imagine a kind of non-Lewisian view where I'm considering different systems, where I'm considering different natural choices of natural kinds, then time comes in as a kind of, it's all a kind of package, the time plus the natural properties and everything.
I don't think something.
Yeah, maybe measurability.
Measurability is obviously, in some sense, relativized to what we can observe because we have to observe pointer observables and so on. But that wouldn't be a strong restriction, and maybe it's enough to get you what you need.
I just worry about whether there still might be a time-space split already in measurability. Thanks.
Here?
One little thing that it just strikes me that if the measurable properties include velocities, then the time is built in, which they usually be x and x dot of initial data. So x dot is derivative of respect to time. So.
Well, measure the positions of measurement at different times.
Measurements can be over time.
Yeah.
I've got a comment and a question. The comment is about one of the slides somewhere in the middle. I forget the exact heading, but it had MRL, Bill Ramsey Lewis, in the title. I think it was the one which had the little spinning sundial. Can you go back to that?
You just want to see the spinning sundial again, don't you?
Wait till you see the graphics on the Sunday talk. Cox Eye stuff lends itself to graphics better.
I also want to ask you who that guy is.
I had to skip it. Hedenborg, he's the one. He suggested all physics should be in search of well-posed Cauchy problems, which is now viewed as naive because most problems in physics textbooks are not well-posed.
I just wanted to point out to you, and you'd know this already if the weather hadn't been so bad, but your sundial is actually going around the wrong way.
Oh.
You'll see if the weather improves. Another question. Think about the question, what is time, from the point of view of somebody who was very into the sort of mid-20th century project, the saying that relativity has shown us that time is specialized. So someone might have said, well, look, there isn't any deep difference. It's just that one direction is kind of picked out from our point of view because it's the kind of direction in which our segments of consciousness are spread out, direction in which our world lines are spread out. And in a sense, that's still an answer that one could give to your question again. But it's a different answer to the one that you give. And so a natural question, and one that's come up already, in a sense, in the background in some of the discussions so far, is what's the connection between those two answers? Is it kind of accidental, or is it is there some sort of deep explanation as to why it should be the case that turns out that the direction in which our consciousness is spread out is the direction which also has this other characteristic?
Right. That's a good question. I think there's a connection, but I mean, you could put the question in terms of consciousness, or you could even just think about it in terms of, I don't know, persisting world lines. I sent the paper to Carl Hafer. He suggested something like this, where he said, why couldn't we say the difference between time and space is that the difference is that we have, and one, time is the direction in which world lines don't bend over. Here would be another one. Time is the direction in which our consciousness is defined. I think that they probably are deeply related because, if we had a world where the direction of where you could get strong predictions, you could certainly imagine, as a kind of logically possible world where the direction of prediction is different than the direction in which conscious states evolve, and different than where world lines tend to typically bend over or something. But when you think about why would scientists in such a world choose the natural times that they do? It's partly for strength, and in that way they're getting a kind of sort of automatic connection to, not having the stuff of the world too screwed up according to these the choice of natural kinds, if we think of the consciousness as kind of choice of natural kind or something, maybe evolution is sensitive to the time-space split, and you know, creatures latch on to the direction of, you know, better strength and evolve a certain way. So now we think in terms of the direction of strength, but it's all very speculative. But in my heart, that's what I believe.
Right.
I was going to ask something about that, as you just mentioned, actually. That I was wondering, because a lot of the stuff about strength, as you presented it, was in terms of doing physics. And that's very important, I think, and I liked a lot of the framework of the whole paper approach. But it would be interesting to flesh out how the idea of strength might relate to creatures. Not just consciousness, but you know, aspects of coping with the environment and making decisions and so forth. And I wonder, I mean, the more that it's possible to relate the strength in the physics sense of prediction and so forth, well, especially problems, the more it's possible to relate that to the life of creatures, the more interesting it becomes as a
I agree entirely. The original version of this paper was more ambitious, and I was going on about evolution being the ultimate patent detection device and that kind of thing. And I agree, it makes them even the very question, what's the difference between time and space? I mean, when you approach it from this naturalistic point of view, you can just say, well, you know, these equations are different than those equations, and makes it more interesting if you can connect it up with more things. And, but you know, I just, you know, there was that slide, I don't know, maybe three quarters of the way through, where I just got kind of flummoxed with how I would go about. People, when I gave the talk the first few times, you know, I was talked that way, you know, people would come up with all these zillions of different things where I'm getting information across the spatial surface as I go, you know, in economics and biology and. You know, just day-to-day life, and you know, walk around on streets and stuff like this, tree rings and things, and I just didn't know how to quantify, you know, which one is the predominant direction of strength at the higher level, where it seems so clear at the lower level. So then I've just sort of given up. But that's the original ambition, and the continuing secret ambition is to be able to answer your question. And if people think about it and have any suggestions for me, I'm happy to hear them, because I would like to, you know, connect up the physical level more with the. Because I don't think it's an accident that, you know, time marches. Economic markets develop, and entropy develops. To the same beat of the drum as particles do. You know, so that there is this time-space split also. In these higher levels, I don't think it's an accident. I think it's amazing when you think about it. So you can say what you want about reduction between different theories and non-reduction between different theories, but it's amazing how transparent the time-space split is through all these different theories. You know, so it's not like the time-space split of some high-level theory is orthogonal to some time-space split at some lower-level theory. And you want an answer to why that is. I don't have an answer.
I think maybe you suggested one possibility. It might be that it's a priori that at least some parts of Darwinian theory go in the same direction as the one you've picked out. Maybe.
Maybe.
That was a finger. Any more hands? Yep.
In the work of Julia Barber, property says relational, and he sort of gives a similar idea as yours, and you can get time as a great simplifier. Two questions. What do you think of that idea and those ideas? And do you think that being relational of properties makes it easier to find this weird secret file.
Well, I mean, what I think about the... I mean, I don't think the relationist counterpart of general relativity that Barbara comes up with is general relativity. I mean, so they're not equivalent. But they might be empirically equivalent, and then... I don't know. I have to say, I do love all that sort of best matching from one slice to another slice. And in fact, yeah, some of this stuff is motivated by that. And in fact, if you look through all the details of the Barbara, you can see that you can do the best matching a certain way, where you would have a Euclidean space-time instead of a Lorentzian one. And then he says, no, but if we do that, then we can't get a well-posed Cauchy problem. And so you see connections there. As far as what I think about, I mean, I'm tend to, you know, by nature, I tend to be more a substantivalist than a relationalist. But I don't think it really has much to do with the simplicity. Whether it being easier to find simplicity with relations. No.
Okay, well, I understand philosophy of time much better now than I did at the beginning of the talk, so that supports your theory. Although, unfortunately, I also note that if I was one of the people a bit further in that direction, spatially, I'd also understand philosophy of time better. So that's a pity. But anyway, thank you very much.